This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Mark Stevens, standing here on the platform at Fort William Station, preparing to jump aboard the Jacobite steam train to Malik. Now, the West Highland Line's been voted as one of the world's most spectacular train journeys. It's got everything. It's got scenery, it's got history, it's got glamour, and, of course, the association with Harry Potter and the Hogwarts Express. Over the next hour, we're going to be exploring this celebrated landscape and bringing some meaning to the scenery. My fellow traveller, here's Ewan McElraith.
This is so exciting. We've got 370 people who are just loving this. This is brilliant. We're rushing because the train is just about to leave. But what's been clear from exploring we've done over the mountains, the lochs and the caves between Fort William and Malik, they've all got a particular story to tell about our nation's history.
In the posted walk, 2,000 foot from the lochshore up to the rock and deposit the parcels and whatever else. I can't imagine my postie walking up there to deliver my post.
When you come in here on the steam train, you know, it's... try to think of a nice way of putting this. It's not the bonniest of places. It could be tidier.
This is a bone of contention with me, because we'll never be a Plockton. You know, we're never going to win any awards for beauty. But I'll tell you, for industry and effort, we're top of the heap.
You've got to treat it well. It's like a woman. If you don't treat them well, that's it.
Yeah.
Same with this. When there's no fire in the dead, there's nothing there. But you put a fire in the box and they come alive.
If you can imagine, I mean, you've got this fantastic piece of built heritage. You've got the activity that the yachts and the towpath customers bring.
Ben Nevis across there.
Exactly. It's sitting within the spectacular setting of Great Glen below Ben Nevis, and you've got a steam train going past. It takes a lot of beating, really.
They're waiting for us. Come on, go.
Get on board.
Next.
Great. Savage by a dog. Great.
This is just so dramatic. Alex, the driver, is sticking his head out of the footplate there. And you can see smuts of black soot blowing out from the front of the train. And because it's really putting some effort in, the smoke coming out of the stack is changing from a sort of a sooty grey colour all the way to this pure white. But this, it's not a machine. It really isn't a machine. When this thing's got fire in its belly, it is alive. That banging noise you can hear is us going across the swing bridge at Banavy. We're heading out of Fort William and off down Loch Eel, where every year hundreds of yachts journey from east to west or vice versa, all thanks to the Caledonian Canal, which runs the width of the country from Inverness down to Fort William. And it really opens up the west coast for yachties. We've got this masterpiece of engineering, Neptune Staircase. We can look right up from the train here, up the various locks. Russell Thompson of British Waterways explained to me yesterday how it all works.
It is a real classic in terms of Scottish built heritage. It's 200 years old. The Caledonian Canal was opened in 1822, and the Neptune Staircase itself was constructed between approximately 1808 and 1812. Actually done ahead of schedule, which was, I don't know if it was rare then. I don't know if it was rare then, but certainly rare now, yes.
Designed by Thomas Telford.
Yes.
What's the height that it actually lifts these boats?
Boats will have come in from the sea, come through the sea lock and the double lock at Corpach, and each of our locks raise boats approximately 8 feet. So by the time they get to the bottom of Neptune Staircase here, they'll be about 24 feet above sea level. And then by the time they go through the full 8 locks of Neptune Staircase, they'll be almost 90 feet above sea level.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. Now, just explain,
what actually happens? I mean, they come in at one level, the gates close behind them, what happens then?
Yeah, the boats you see going through just now are going up the staircase. So they will come in the bottom lock, the lock gates will close behind them. The water from above feeds into the lock they are in, which will bring them up slowly up to the level of the next lock that they wish to go into. The lock gates open, they move on, the lock gates close behind them, and that same process continues as they work their way up the flight of locks.
You've got three glass fibre yachts sitting in here at the moment. How busy can it get?
When we get to the height of summer, we can see up to 20 boats going through here in one given day.
Must be merry bedlam.
It's great fun. I don't know if the staff would always describe it as great fun, but no, they have a fantastic amount of interaction with the customers. We're dealing with people who really know their way around their own boats. Some of them will be experienced in the canal before and some not. The numbers can fluctuate a lot, but throughout the year we will see about 1,400, 1,500 boats do the full length of the Caledonian Canal from sea to sea, and a lot of them are coming from outside the UK. Yeah.
Is trade increasing, decreasing, staying static? What?
I think year on year we're seeing a slight increase in our transit market. It can fluctuate year on year, but gradually we're seeing an increase in that transit market. Obviously, by far, the majority are those from leisure craft. Yeah. We do have about 25% of our transit customers are work boats, fishing boats, dredgers, that sort of thing. Vast majority are leisure. About 50% of them come from outside the UK, Northern Europe, and really the strongest individual market for us is Scandinavia. Yeah. Sweden and Norway make up about a third of all the yachts passing through here.
Yeah. I was here this morning and there was a really big sort of cruiser going down in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And I heard the tannoy system saying, and if you pay attention, ladies and gentlemen, in about 10 minutes' time, the steam train will be going past. And I thought, well, that's good timing by somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe a little bit difficult to paint the picture in radio, but if you can imagine, I mean, you've got this fantastic piece of built heritage. You've got the activity that the yachts and the towpath customers bring.
Ben Nevis across there.
Exactly. It's sitting within the spectacular setting of Great Glen below Ben Nevis, and you've got a steam train going past. Takes a lot of beating, really.
There's the next set of gates opening now. Now, presumably, they don't use motors on these things. They're just roped forward. They're pulled forward?
They will pull themselves forward. We don't encourage people to have their engines running because there are several boats in the lock there at the moment. As you can imagine, particularly when the water level is at a lower level, if they were all running their engines, you're in a bit of an enclosed space there. It could get quite smoky and the fumes. This is the most sustainable and efficient way of getting them through. The water is flowing naturally from up down through the sluices, and the boats will pull themselves through. Occasionally, they'll use their engines if they don't have enough crew or if the wind picks up to control it. And then once they get into the next lock, the engines stop again once everything's tied up, and the process continues.
It's only when, you know, these gates have opened, these boats are slowly moving their way through, and there is this solid wall in front of them that must be nearly, 18, 20 feet high, water spilling across the top of it.
Yeah.
It's the scale of the achievement here is quite extraordinary, and the size of the car park is a real indication of how big a tourist attraction this is.
Yeah.
Lots of people want to see this in action.
Yeah, that's what I say. It's this combination of the natural heritage, the setting, and the activity the boats bring. This is not something that people do every day, is being able to see boats pass through a canal, the whole action of the locks, the way the guys interact with our customers as well. I think a lot of people get a lot of fun out of it, and we really want to encourage people to come along and see this fantastic spectacle for themselves.
...1977 was the last time I was in a carriage like this. There's the passageway up the outside, and then you have this little enclosed compartment that's really intended for six people. This is a first-class one, and it's all dark wood and, you know, reasonably plush seating, and it's just, you know, it's a proper train. It's a proper train.
It's as you would expect a train to look like, and probably it's less economic than modern-day ones, but it's just so much character, and it's great. You can shut the rest of the world off and enjoy it.
Given the chance, into our little holy of holies, we've admitted Neil McLeod here. Now, You've got an unusual situation here, Neil. You run the buffet car, but you're also the historian. What's the history of this? How did it come about in the first place?
When it was first decided in 1896, when it first got the Act of Parliament, it was actually a lot of people, landlords and estate owners and farmers, who actually paid the money for the development of it, because the line had already come up from Glasgow to Fort William, and they suddenly saw the potential of it. So, in fact, during the journey itself, you'll see one or two stations which are request stop only. That is because a landlord said, I'll give you money if you can put a station in. And to this day, it's a request stop only. It wasn't planned in the building of the line. And certainly when they did build the line, one of the people who put the money in was somebody who wanted to develop the fishing. They saw the potential of it, and that was one factor. But there was a lot of people who donated the money towards the building of it.
You were telling me earlier about, it's a fairly odd fact, the number of bakeries along this line.
Well, when it was being built, they decided that they felt that just to keep the workmen in good form and good health, that there would be a baker's and a shop at certain periods along the line. Now, this was the easiest build of the line to build, so they put a baker's at the top end of the Lochiote, and whenever they wanted to get fresh food, there was always one there. Fresh bread was made every day.
Yeah.
Keep the workers happy.
Perfect.
I mean, I don't know about you, Ewan, but I mean, this seemed to me like a real League of Nations job. There was a cast of thousands out there from all different nationalities.
Yeah, there's an amazing amount of nations and people on here. It's attracting everybody. 370-odd folk on this train today, apparently, including us. All of them having a ball. But the fish thing just really drove it, didn't it? This was fueled on herring.
Well, yes, it was one of the mainstays of income for the railway service, was the fish industry coming up. I mean, there were trains going on the days, and many, many wonderful stories about the train service. I mean, one of the best ones is, as we're travelling along here, you'll come to a place called Essenbothy. And the story was that there was a light on in Essenbothy, and the fireman and the driver of the engine said, what's happening in the bothy? So the fireman went over, there's a wee party going on. So the driver went over to see where the fireman was, and there was a wee party going on. And the party was so good that by the time they got back to the steam engine, the fire had gone out.
And we've just stopped at one of those wee request stops at the moment, and it's just fantastic looking out over the loch, isn't it? Tremendous.
Yeah. What's wonderful about this journey is that the scenery changes every day. If you were travelling yesterday, it was a bit overcast, a bit moody. Today it's glorious sunshine. You can see the verdant hills. It's just great.
Yeah. How big an impact, we're going to talk about this later in the programme, but how big an impact have the Harry Potter films had on this?
Who he?
Oh, come now, come on, don't dissemble.
Harry Potter's obviously had a huge effect because parts of this line are used in the film itself. I mean, people say this is the Harry Potter train, which is technically incorrect because actually Harry Potter is a fictitious train. Hogwarts Express is a fictitious train. I'm sorry.
You can't say that.
But so there's parts of it. And yes, I mean, people will come and suddenly realise, of course, we'll be crossing Glenfinnan Viaduct very soon. And that is the iconic image in one of the Harry Potter films. There's lots of shots of that. When we're travelling in Lochiote, we see the beautiful trees and the islands. Again, that's used in the Harry Potter films. So yes, it's helped enormously.
Yeah.
Well, what's the fascination with steam? Why? I mean, you could do it. We're looking out the window. It doesn't matter if there's a steam train up front. Why do the likes of us get so fired up about it?
My brother, who lives in Edinburgh, came up the other day and he asked me that very same question. And I said, the difference is between a diesel and a steam engine is a diesel engine can be turned on with a key. A steam engine takes an hour and a half, 2 hours to get ready, and it comes to life slowly but surely. It's like getting up in the morning. It's very tired and unsummersome, and as the day goes on, it gets more awake and alert.
Actually, on the subject of the engine, which is fabulous, earlier we took the opportunity to actually go up onto the footplate, you know, with the roaring fire there, and have a word with Alex Ian MacDonald, who's the driver.
This loco, this is a Class 5, Black 5 loco, traction loco, you know.
It's identical to the type of train I had as a boy in my train set, my Hornby train set. It's got a 4.62 or something like that. You're going to put me right here.
That's right, 4.60, this one, 4.60.
You were very close, very close. I'm now very worried about him.
And what does that mean?
Well, you've sort of bogey in the front, four on three driving wheels.
The heat in here is absolutely phenomenal, man. I know I'm standing right in front of this thing, and you can see the fire going back maybe about 10 feet thereabouts. How do you fire the coal that far in? There must be a technique.
It's just sort of practice and skill, and you just sort of get a good swing, and after you've done it a few times, it'll go down the front. And when the engine's working hard, it's like to pull down the front on its own. So,
what happens if it doesn't go down the front, Neil? I mean, if you were only to load it halfway down?
The engine wouldn't steam, and Alec wouldn't have enough steam to get up the hills. Yeah. And we'd have to stop and have a thing called a blow-up, and we hopefully won't be doing that today.
I was chasing this thing yesterday to get photographs and video of it, and having huge fun. I mean, it looks fantastic, you know, along this on this sectional line. Yeah, it really looks spot on. But one thing that strikes you, because I mean, I know nothing about steam, it sounds like a living thing. You know, when it's going uphill, you can hear it start to, it's breathing labours.
That's right, that's right. You've got to understand it. You've got to treat it well, it's frightened like a woman. If you don't treat them well, that's it. Yeah. Same with this.
I've always been too frightened not to treat a woman well.
well,
I suspect it's much the same with it.
Yes, I think they're very, very... When there's no fire in the dead, there's nothing there. But you put a fire in the box and it come alive. Yeah. And that's
I think, I mean, have individual engines got individual characters?
They have. They're all, there's no two the same. Yeah. Even the same type, you'll get one that's a bit different.
Yeah. And is this a comfortable engine to work in?
It is. It's quite a smooth running engine. You know? Yeah. Some of them with the smaller wheels are a bit shaky and that, you know. They're not.
Does this become more than a job, or is it kind of a boyhood dream? I know it's an obvious question.
Yeah, well, it's when I started my career in the railways, it was all steam, you know, so it looks like a train, put it that way. More like a train back than the diesel, you know. And smoke belching out and working hard, struggling some places, but we get there.
Just coming around the bend now, heading into Harry Potter territory, just approaching the famous viaduct at Glenfinnan. Obviously, not only famous for the viaduct and for Harry Potter, but for a major event here which changed the course of British history. The story begins at the other end of Lough Shiel, where Charles Edward Louis John Casimir Sylvester Severino Maria Stuart, also known as Bonnie Prince Charlie, thank you very much, the full-blood prince, stage-managed his triumphant arrival in pursuit of his father's disputed throne. Ewan joined Jim Mickey aboard Sheilas at Acharachal.
Well, a very good afternoon to you all, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome aboard Sheilas. And welcome to Lough Shiel, especially for the folks that have just joined us.
We're at the sea end of Lough Shiel. We're looking out over in our right here, lovely mountain called Ben Rishapaw. On the other side of that is the seawater loch of Lough Sunert. There's a big flat area kind of below it, which is a national nature reserve, which is called Claish Moss. And it's noted for what's known as patterned raised mire, which are domes of peat, some of them up about 15 foot deep, and they're surrounded by some moats of water. So it's quite an unusual phenomenon. It's just another few examples of this in this area.
Quite a stiff breeze blowing today. We can hear it slapping against the sides of the boat. You're talking about the sea end, but this is a freshwater loch. This isn't a sea loch.
No, it's a freshwater loch, which was formed by successive ice ages, but the last one ended up here about 11,500 years ago. 20,000 years ago, the ice would have been about 2,000 feet above us, so it was only be the tops of the mountains poking up through this big sheet of ice.
I'm guilty of this as well. Most people will probably have seen it as they pass by the monument at Glenfinnan, and that's their extent of the knowledge, but it's quite a hidden wee secret gem.
When you look down the loch from Glenfinnan, something very enticing about it, very inviting, which is one of the reasons that I started doing this. I wanted to find out more about what was in the distance.
At the end of the loch?
Yes, aye. There's a lot to it.
This has got a real African Queen-type quality about it at the moment. We're just going through some quite shallow water at the upper end of the loch, weaving through some sandbars. It's like going through one of the great rivers in Africa. You almost expect elephants to be at the side. It is that dramatic, and it's beautiful, and the stunning colour of the gorse. You can get the waves of coconut. Off to the left you've got a merganser, a fish eating duck, and right in front of me one of the rarest birds in Scotland. This is the black-throated diver, and it really is a beautiful sleek bird.
The name's Colin Morley. I've worked with Jim for 6 years now on the boat. we've affectionately named this one Dozy.
That's a bit cruel.
Well, he's been here for about 4 or 5 years now on the lock, and he's always on his own, and generally hangs around, and you know, we sail past him and he's fast asleep, or we spotted him a couple of years ago just with an eel in his mouth, reversing the eel. You know, the eel was trying to get out, he was trying to swallow it. They're just a superb diving bird. Rubbish on land. They lay the eggs very close to the shoreline. And on this lock, the lock can go up by, you know, 8 to 10 feet in, you know, a matter of 4 or 5 days. He's just coming into his sort of breeding plumage just now. And they're gorgeous, absolutely, you know, black on the back, white on the front. Absolutely smooth diving bird. I've watched these dive under the water, and they've gone 1/4 mile underwater before they come back up again. So they're immense diving birds.
We're passing a lovely little burial island, which is known as Ellen Ianan, which translates as St. Finan's Isle, and locally known as the Green Isle. And St. Finan was a kind of contemporary of St. Columba, and landed here in the 6th century. And this island here became the hub of his mission to spread the word of Christianity in this area. So this became the sort of very sacred ground and the main burial island for the folk in the surrounding, wide surrounding area from here. So there's literally tens of thousands of people buried in this little, tiny little island. So there's so many people on it that I used to know the old gravedigger here, the man Hugh MacDonald, they call him the Gamey. And he, when he was digging a grave, he would come off with a big crowbar, and he would go round the island to the appointed spot, thrust it into the ground, and if it went down too easily, he would say, "Aha, someone there," and he would move to another spot.
A bit of a family divide on either side of the island.
The other side of the loch was granted by royal charter to Clan Campbell. Probably another situation of the government stirring up trouble, putting opposing clans on either side of the loch. And with the granting of the lands came half the island. So we've got kind of two different clans, really, MacDonald's on the left and mainly Campbell and Cameron on the right-hand side as we're viewing it here.
And not resting in peace?
No.
It was our wedding anniversary recently, and our 5 children got together and organised this for us as a wee treat.
Was this something you'd always wanted to do?
Absolutely. We've passed Glenfinnan very many times, and at last we're on the water.
Oh, it's been a fantastic trip. It's Jim's knowledge and his chats. The island here, the St. Finan's burial island, is just, it's a magical place. It's delightful to look at.
And it's just carpeted in bluebells and azaleas, and it's gorgeous.
You can smell the azaleas, and we've done the round trip, and then the way up, the scent was absolutely stunning, just wonderful. Yep.
Well, the countryside's really changed now. We've gone from rivers in Africa to real Scottish stuff. Just passing a lovely glen, Glen Allerdale, and this is where Bonnie Prince Charlie stage managed his big PR bit to go and gather the clans and set the heather alight.
He arrived in the island of Eriskay and was taken by boat to the mainland, which is not that far from here. Then he walked kind of over the hills onto the side of the loch here, and he was picked up by a boat. They were called Beerlands in these days. They were kind of modelled in the Viking longship design, large double-ended crafts with maybe 16 oars. And they were provided by the chieftain of Clan Ranald, whose seat was at a castle sitting at the foot of the River Shiel here, Castle Chirrum, the dry castle.
So it would have been a kind of old equivalent of the stage-managed media circus photo opportunity. Here I am.
Yeah, that's definitely. And I mean, he chose no finer point to land and gather the troops.
This area, Loch Shiel, we're just coming past a place called Eagle Rock, for obvious reasons. There's a big area, a big boulder at the bottom of the rock, which is locally known as the Post Office Rock. And in years gone by, when the post used to come in by boat and the shepherds were working in the hills and glens beyond, this was basically their sort of post office. There's a big dry area behind the rock, and the postie had walked 2,000 foot from the lock shore up to the rock and deposit the parcels and whatever else. I can't imagine my postie walking up there to deliver my post.
Ewan and passengers there on Sheelis and Loch Sheel, just below the monument at Glenfinnan. We've stopped at the station at Glenfinnan here. You can actually, just over the head of that hill there across the dining car, see the monument. One of the most iconic pieces of statuary anywhere in Scotland.
Just it's not tower. Quite as impressive as the viaduct, which you get such a belt
phenomenal.
Sticking your head out the window. It's tremendous.
Yesterday, I was down in the wee valley there, looking at the train crossing the viaduct, getting some video footage. The view from the train, however, looking down that, is phenomenal. Needless to say, there's a piper kicked up in
somebody
the background.
Somebody always
there.
Wants to ruin it.
Oh, somebody wants to ruin it. But the monument itself, I mean, you have the view of the hills coming in, you've got the loch, you've got this great pillar, and then this statue of a Jacobite soldier on the top of it. I mean, it's a phenomenal piece of work. It's owned and run by the National Trust for Scotland, where Rudy Vakanapala is the property manager.
Well, what we've got here is a monument to commemorate the Jacobites who fought on that during the raising of the standard in 1745, the cause that led Bonaparte Prince Charlie trying to regain the throne for his father, which obviously ended very dramatically in Culloden in 1746. The monument is built in Glenfinnan because he raised the standard in Glenfinnan, but nobody knows for sure the exact spot of where the standard was raised. There's a couple of stories about it and a couple of points that might be the exact spot, but nobody knows for certain. But it's definitely the best location for a monument.
This has to, I mean, as you say, it's a fantastic location from the road, from the rail line, you know, just geographically, because I mean, you have this wonderful sort of U-shaped loch coming up. This at the head of it. Who built this?
It was built by Alexander MacDonald, who was one of the grandchildren of one of Bonnie Prince Charlie's followers. He commissioned the monument and it was erected in 1815. Unfortunately, he died in Edinburgh just before it was actually finished. But we still say it is very amazing that they were allowed to build a monument to commemorate the Jacobites only that close after the 1745.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, I suppose, about 70 years later.
70 years later,
not far off it.
Especially if you know what happened to the Jacobite supporters after Culloden, than to actually been able to build a monument to commemorate that fact. That's pretty amazing.
Things were beginning to change. You don't really notice this from the road, but we've come round the side because, I mean, it is so busy today. It's absolutely, well, we're toyed with the idea of going up the monument, standing at the top, but, I mean, there's a queues to get up it. Is it my imagination or is that thing squint?
It is, yes. It leans over about 10.5 inches. And the main reason, well, there's actually two reasons for that. This is basically sand ground, so it's not very stable. And there used to be a two-storey bothy on the right-hand side of the monument looking towards the loch side. Now, in the 1830s, they took the bothy down and actually built a perimeter wall. And I think, in a way, it lost its support from that side and it started to lean over. But it's quite stable, just it's not going to fall over.
No, but maybe the original builders weren't so daft after all. They knew that they needed the two-storey bothy.
Yes, they knew what they were doing.
The figure on the top, is that actually Charles Edward Casimir Stuart?
No. It's not, no. It's an unknown Jacobite Highlander, and that is one of the nice stories about it as well. The sculptor, John Greenshields, who was commissioned to build the statue, had to go to a house to pick up a portrait of Bonaparte Prince Charlie, and the story goes that he picked up the wrong portrait, so it's an unknown Jacobite Highlander.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever been in the Cameron Lough Eel Museum. They have Bonaparte Prince Charlie's waistcoat there.
Yeah.
My 13-year-old daughter couldn't get into it. I mean, he's a very, very, I mean, he's obviously a hardy soul, judging by his escape, but I mean, a very, very slight young man.
He probably must have been, if you look at the paintings of him, because he was in his early 20s when he came to Glenfinnan, and obviously a lot of people thought he was a very bonny lad, very slim, very thunder, a bit of an Italian look because he was raised and brought up mostly in Italy.
Lots and lots of people take photographs of this. It's one of the great iconic images of Scotland. What's the best time of the year or best time of the day to actually come here and see it?
The best pictures, I reckon, are either very early in the morning before 10 o'clock when the sun actually hits the monument, because in the afternoon it goes behind it and then the only thing you can see is a silhouette, and then either autumn or springtime. Yeah. Springtime, beautiful pictures in the morning.
Yeah. We just turn round and look back towards the visitor centre, and of course behind that you've got the viaduct.
Yes.
And you've got a whole, I would imagine, a whole new range of visitors coming to see that because of the Harry Potter connection.
Most of our visitors nowadays are because of Harry Potter.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. We can see that in postcard sales in the shop. 7 out of 10 postcards sold in the shop are from the viaduct. Three out of ten are for the monument. Most people come here because of Harry Potter and to take pictures of the viaduct.
Remember a few years ago when they were filming on that, I don't know if you were around at the time, but sparks came out of the train and set the heather on fire and fencing was damaged and all that kind of stuff.
It happens every year.
Yeah,
it happens a couple of weeks ago.
Well, it was unfortunate for the film company. I was actually talking to a guy from Network Rail just a week afterwards, but something completely different. And I was pulling his leg about it and said, oh, you know, how awful. And he says, he says, it was a magical fire. I says, really? He says, yes. Says, there was fence lines caught fire 2 miles upwind. They're not daft locally.
No.
Film company paid up and that was that.
Oh, they have to. But, I mean, it is obviously very dangerous and you have to watch out. But I remember about 5-6 years ago, this entire hillside was on fire. Uh-huh. And the year after, it was covered in bluebells. So it was very, very nice, very beautiful.
Yeah. Rudy Vakarapala at Glenfinnan there. You're listening to a special edition of Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland with me, Mark Stephen, and him, Ewan McElraith. Today, we're taking you one of the world's truly great journeys from Fort William to Malleg on the Jacobite steam train. And the train makes one stop here at Glenfinnan. And we've come off onto the platform, and there's this tiny little museum here. Hege Helnes is one of the people in charge of this museum. What is all this stuff? Where did it all come from?
Well, most of it originated from the station. It very much is as it was left by British Rail when they no longer needed the station buildings for their operation. So we were fortunate enough to come in before it was all emptied.
What are you playing with? What are you doing?
I don't know, there's a handle, so I pulled it.
And the train's just gone, yeah.
Oh, this is the old Tolkien instruments. It's really the things that were in place to make sure that the trains didn't crash on the line because it's you know, it's a single line. Yeah.
So it's a token working system. You can't progress unless you have the token.
That's
and then
very
it had
it.
To be handed across on the other side and things. See if you break any of this.
Well, that's where all the tickets for the various destinations were put. So you had one little cubbyhole for each of the types of tickets.
Yeah. Well, there's 370 people waiting outside to get in here, so I suggest we get back to the train. Hege, thank you very much for that. Much obliged, you. Just listen to that. This is what we're talking about. We're pulling out of Glenfinnan. I can't remember what the incline is here, but 1 in 45 or something like that. Which really has to work, you know, in order to get traction and move.
But not just that, your sense of excitement actually builds into the rhythm of the train because you start slowly and you can actually feel adrenaline pumping as you get faster and faster and faster.
Yeah.
Now just past Lough Eilert station, and in the distance on the other side of the Lough Eilert itself you can see Inver Eilert Castle, which was in 1941 was part of the SOE development of the commandos as asked by Winston Churchill.
What's SOE mean?
A Special Operations
Executive.
Thank you. Teamwork. And if you go into the castle, the post office for the village is still within the castle at the moment. And if you are fortunate enough to ask, you can be taken into the castle and you can still see there's signs saying Captain Secretary only, Wrens only, and various other bits. So it's still part of the history of the SOE is still within the castle itself.
Huge fish farms down there too.
Very first fish farm in Scotland is there. It came in the late 60s, I think in 1969. The local landowner of Inver Eilert Castle saw potential of employment for the community. So when Marine Harvest and asked, could we set up a fish farm? Certainly no problem at all, and it's been there since 1969.
You were mentioning earlier something about a hospital too.
Lough Eilert, during the construction of the line, was one of the main bases for all the workers. There was 2,000 navvies based in Lough Eilert. There's a lovely flat plain beside the River Eilert itself. And it was also the very first place that had an industrial hospital because it was such a huge workforce. And that hospital had 8 beds, 2 nurses and a doctor. So obviously working in a region like this, a regime like this, obviously accidents are going to happen. So the engineers had the presence of mind to help the workers, like going back to the bakers and the shops as well. Just on the left-hand side here, you've got one of the few things that was constructed during the building of it. That's Loch Dhu, which means the Black Loch. And during the building of the line, Robert McAlpin's son, who was one of the engineers, was having real difficulty in getting through the rocks formation and this. So they had steam turbines, but they just could not get the power to knock away the rock. And Robert McAlpin's son had toothache, and he went down to Glasgow, and the dentist there had this new drill which was run by water. And he suddenly realized the power of water, the pressure that you could build up with water was such that they blocked that small lock, created Loch Doo, and then started to go into the rock formation greater distances, about a mile and a half through flexible pipes. And without that intelligent and brilliant idea, it would have probably taken far longer to construct this line.
If they'd got through at all.
Yeah.
We said right at the beginning of this that, you know, your first instinct, and I think this probably applies to everybody, is to get really overexcited when you get on this train, you know, and your excitement, it is, you know, the cadence of your excitement is really measured by the way the train goes. After a while, it becomes soporific. I mean, is that a usual occurrence?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're travelling out in some beautiful, beautiful scenery. It's relaxing. You're sitting, you're just looking, you're doing nothing. We don't go any faster than 43 miles an hour. And so with the natural roll of it or the heat coming in, the fact you're relaxed, it's just a great day out.
Neil, thanks very much for that. Just to sort of update you, you're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElwraith. We're currently puffing our way towards Malig, just round the corner from here, and over a very small viaduct, you get your first glimpse of the small isles and out to sea. And as Neil's just been talking about, there is history absolutely everywhere you go around here. As Helen discovered just a mile or two west when she met up with countryside ranger Angus McIntyre.
At the moment, we're standing on the bridge beside the Borrowdale Burn, close to both Arisig House and Borrowdale House.
And where are you going to take me?
I'm going to take you to Charlie's Cave and the Vitrified Fort. My wife, she used to get half a crown for taking people to the cave.
You would never know this was here, which is a kind of obvious thing to say, because...
Well, that's it.
Down in
that's
there.
A cave. It goes back about, well, from where you can see, it goes back about another 30 feet. But from here, you got a great view. I mean, if you appreciate that Charlie was waiting for the French ships to come and collect him. So before he got here, there was two French privateers were out there waiting for him. And they were spotted by the English sloops. So there was quite a bloody battle out in that little bit of water there. One of the French ships was so confident, because he saw this wee boat coming towards them, that they stayed at anchor, which was a bad mistake, because the wee sloops were able to go round and shoot from sort of bow and stern. However, it finished up really that nobody won, but there were the remains of French sailors getting washed ashore here for about 15 days afterwards. Strange thing was, there was no British sailors getting washed ashore here, but it turns out that they didn't actually dump any bodies overboard until the sloops got back round Ardnamurchan Point. But at the same time, looking from the cave here, you can see how good a view we had of anyone coming to collect them.
Oh, it's just amazing. I mean, looking out here, it's a beautiful view, and just trying to imagine what it would have been like.
Yes, well, you know, I suppose for him it was a matter of urgency. You know, all he wanted to do was get away to France, because the English troops were literally everywhere. They were laying waste all the way up the coast here. It was pretty serious stuff. You know, villages were getting razed to the ground. It was just about as bad as you can get.
Well, Angus, I'm going to have to go and have a look in that cave.
You're well advised to go in backwards. You can actually touch both sides with your hands.
Yeah, and it's wet, isn't it?
And it's quite wet just now, but normally it doesn't get too wet. And actually, funny thing is, I've lit a fire at the far end of the cave here, and you're hard pushed to see where any smoke comes out. It's quite strange.
There are a lot of myths and rumours about, you know, people say, oh, Bonnie Prince Charlie stayed in this cave and that cave and every single cave along the West Coast.
That's right.
Is there strong evidence that he did actually use this cave? This was
There's
his cave.
There's very strong evidence that he used this cave because my wife's great-great-great-grandfather was alive at the time and passed it on, passed it down the line.
Right, Angus, I think we should head back out into the sunshine.
Right, watch your head, for goodness sake.
Well, Angus, we came away from the cave, across the field, and now we're on top of something rather special with just amazing views.
Yeah, well, this is a vitrified fort. As you can see, wonderful all-round vision, a real panorama. The interesting thing about them, really, is the walls that are built around them. The stones in the wall are actually fused together, and we don't know how it was done.
How long ago was this built?
Well, it's anybody's guess. I mean, it could be right back Iron Age. We just don't know. You can see there, it's covered with mosses and lichens now, but these are all actually stuck together, well stuck together. And again, if you just look about you, is that not a wonderful view? It is a bit misty down Ardamarican Point way, but that's the peninsula, the peninsula that runs down past the Harachal. You can see Ben Head there. Over here, you've got what used to be quite a well-populated place over at Pinmianach, which is over behind the point there. On the far side is the Glenuig shore. You can just about see the houses at Glenuig now. Your lookout post here would basically function for a huge area behind us, you know, basically the whole of like the Arisig estate. Anyone coming at all from the southwest would be spotted long before they were close enough to do any damage.
And looking back up, this is amazing because it seems quite wild and untouched, but then you look inland and you see this bit of engineering at the end there.
That was good old Concrete Bob that built that, McAlpin. And that particular one, I don't know whether you've heard or not, but there's the remains of a horse and cart buried in the concrete. And that is fact because it was actually x-rayed just a few years ago now after the centenary, and you can actually see it on the x-ray. So it's quite something.
Now, this land for you, it's obviously a place that you love.
Having lived here all my life, I'm still learning about it. I think spring is probably my favourite. When you see so many different greens, the trees all in different stages, I just think it's tremendous altogether. I mean, I've been only to as far as New Zealand, but there's nothing is any better, and there's very few actually compare.
Angus McIntyre and Helen there, looking up to the Loch Nanua viaduct from the coast below Arisaig House. We're just going across at the moment, and that view out to sea is phenomenal.
That view, when we could see it 30 seconds ago, we're just going through a tunnel at the moment, and you've got that fantastic view, and suddenly you're plunged into darkness. The view's back again. There's just a whole myriad of wee islands. It's like, it is like going along the Mediterranean coast. It's just stunning.
Just pulling past now the bay, and you can see the small isles there, the sort of rum, egg, muck, canna.
It's fantastic. You're just looking at some of the best beaches, I would argue, in the world, certainly in Scotland.
Much more open scenery here now, Neil, too.
It is. You can just make out the southern end of Skye as well, the southern end of the tip of Skye, and if it's a good day like it is today, you can see in the distance the red and black Coolans. We're just approaching Mora, and prior to approaching Mora, we'll be crossing River Mora, which is the shortest river in Britain, which is only half a mile long, leaving Loch Mora to the sea. And Loch Mora is the deepest freshwater loch in Europe, deeper than Loch Ness.
And it's got a monster?
It's got a monster called Morag, and it's related, which is related to Nessie. They think that there are chambers connecting the two lochs together.
Why have you got your fingers crossed?
I work in tourism. We're just coming up towards the sands of Mora, which are just stunningly beautiful. And
look at that, it's just coming up through the window. And moored there is, look at that.
It's just a very, very slight hint of pink, but otherwise it's bone white sands.
It's straight out the Caribbean.
Yeah.
You've got a boat anchored there in crystal clear water, white sands. It's just stunning, it's wonderful.
Well, That area is photographed and painted by thousands. Jack Shaw Stewart looks after, and he actually owns, and looks after a stretch of that coastline.
This is the estuary of the River Mora, where quite a short river, but quite a lot of volume of water, and it comes down, joins the sea through this very sandy series of bays.
With our usual exquisite timing, we have come here at high tide, so we're not getting the full benefit of the beach. But what always strikes me about this is, A, the clarity of the water, and B, the colour of it. There's a sort of almost a jade tinge to
it. Oh, yes, particularly when the water is over sand. The sand underneath gives it a terrific colour for some reason. And you get that all the way along the coast. A beautiful, on a calm day, you get these beautiful colours.
These white sands, I mean, and they are almost bone white, you know, where they're dry up at the top there.
Yes.
So the colour of the sea we've already mentioned, patches of blue sky. I mean, this is a stunningly beautiful place.
It's a lovely bit, yes.
The sands themselves, where does the sand come from? What's the composition of the sand?
Well, silica, they all say. I'm not a geologist, but the whole of the west coast of Scotland, there are sandy beaches coming in from where the Atlantic has washed up sand. But most of it is held on the outer side of the outer islands, the Outer Hebrides, and places like Col and Tyree. But for some reason, there's some sort of gap between the islands, and it got into this little strip of coast.
I was told that you have responsibility for part of these beaches, that you look after it, in brackets was how it was phrased. What do you do?
Well, we do the beaches near Arisaig. When I say it's only half a mile of beach, really. It's only one of the many beaches.
To me.
Well, it's only one of the many beaches. We do nothing, really, but we try and keep it clean. That's the most difficult thing. And the other thing is, everybody wants to camp on the beach, but one camper is fine, but 100 campers very quickly spoil a beach. They're picnic beaches, really, and so is this. Plenty of room further inland for camping.
When accidentally we've hit on quite a serious point, you know, under the Land Reform Bill, 2005, how do you stop people camping
on
a beach?
No, it's quite clear, really. The Highland Council has powers to say where you may not camp. Mm-hmm. And a place like this, just between the road and the sea, they have power to say no camping and no caravanning. And they do all the way along here and all the way along our beaches, which is fair enough, really, because campers inevitably light a fire and then they need loos and they need this and they need that, and they, even the best of them, can leave a bit of litter around. So campers are a bit discouraged, but they're very welcome. And there are a lot of camps. There are a dozen campsites between here and Arisaig, within 5 miles.
Just in case we finish on a negative note, because I really don't want to.
No.
Because it is so beautiful. This place is mobbed today. You know, there's families, there's grandparents, there's grandchildren, there's parents, there's, you know.
No, but this is nothing. Come here in August and you can't park a car, you can't. But it's such a big beach that there's room for quite a lot of people.
Does the aesthetic impact, I mean, you've been here all your life, does the aesthetic impact of this ever wear off?
I don't think so, because you get an unaesthetic day, if you can call it that, a really wet day when there's mist and blowing a gale, and we get quite a lot of that. But then you get the next morning, it could be middle of the winter, you suddenly get sun comes out, wind drops, and it's all beautiful again.
Jack Shaw Stewart there at the Sands of Mora, and it's a stunning, stunning location.
When the line was first decided, it was originally going to go to a place called Rochford. But the owner of the estate was a man by the name of Professor Blackburn, who is the Emeritus Professor of Maths in Glasgow University. And he said, I'm not going to have a railway line coming to my back door. I'm not accepting this. And when the Act of Parliament were assessing whether they should give the Act of Parliament, whether they were assessing it all, Lord Kelvin, who was a great friend of Professor Blackburn, told the committee that in the House of Lords that when he went to visit his good friend, he had great difficulty in getting his yacht moored outside his house at Rochford, and so therefore it wouldn't be a fishing harbour of any note. This was despite the fact that the Admiralty chart said it was the best natural harbour in the whole of the West Highlands. The committee said, well, if Lord Kelvin had difficulty with his boat, fair enough. So the line was routed to Mali.
It's not what you know.
Absolutely.
It's who you know.
And so Malik was born.
At that time, Malik just consisted of three or four houses. There was no road to Malik. The railway line actually came to Malik before a road was built from Malik to Fort William, a proper road. It was a track, obviously, but a proper road, the line became before the road.
We're nearing the end of the line now. You get on the train at Fort William about 10:30, you get off about 12:30, there or thereabouts, and Malig is our final destination. Now, Malig's history was really built on the Silver Darlings, the old nickname for the herrings, but these days it's pretty much a tourist town. It's the end of the line for us, but it's the gateway to the Inner Hebrides. Johnny McMillan runs the local tourist centre, and I spoke to him yesterday and asked him how Malig had come to be in the first place.
Well, the reason Malig came to be was because Lord Lovat realised that the crofters were in dire straits early on in the late 1800s, and he thought he would be able to help them. He basically set Malig up as a fishing port. Normally it's crofters who do a bit of fishing, but he set this place up as four families that came here to be fishermen who did a bit of crofting.
How big did it get?
I mean, was this one of the major herring ports?
This was the biggest herring port in Europe in the late 60s, 70s. It was phenomenal, the amount of herring that went through this place.
Are you talking 1860s or 1960s?
1960s, 1970s, yeah. It always was a herring port, but it really, Klondiking came in the 60s, 70s and up to the early 80s.
So what did the harbour look like then?
Crazy. It was a really, really busy harbour. Not so busy nowadays, of course.
You hear people talk about harbours being quite so busy you could walk from one side of the harbour to the other across the decks of boats. That bad?
We have photos to prove it.
And what nationalities were here at the time?
Well, then it was mainly, if you can call them nationalities, they were East Coasters.
Careful. My father's a Brocker, yeah, you need to be, can't he?
Which is where my family came from. They came round here in 1908 from the East Coast. And
where?
From Portesi.
All right, okay.
And from Wick, the Wick Thurso area.
And what happened to the herring when it was brought here?
There were about 10 to 12 kippering yards here. A lot of it was kippered here. A lot of it was lorried out to the East Coast.
I bet you could smell it miles away.
Oh, yes. Lovely smell. Lovely smell. It was the smell of money. That's really what it was, yeah.
When did it start dying out?
Late 70s. The government put an embargo on it to stop the herring fishing because they thought it was being fished out. Now, by all accounts, there's more herring out here than there ever was, but there's no market for it. There's no marketing for it either. You know, it's kippers are still well known, but the two best tastes in fish are the back of a herring and the belly of a salmon, full of oil, full of goodness. But we don't have that anymore, unfortunately.
So what does Malig do nowadays to turn the pound?
Malig mainly, as you can see, it's tourism mainly within the area in the summertime. But there is still quite a healthy shellfish here. Not so much whitefish, but certainly shellfish. It's a good shellfish port, which all the local restaurants would attest to.
When you come in here on the steam train, you know, it's... I'm trying to think of a nice way of putting this. It's not the bonniest of places. It could be tidier.
This is a bone of contention with me, because we'll never be a Plockton. You know, we're never going to win any awards for beauty. But I'll tell you, for industry and effort, we're top of the heap. You know, we are a working village. We're a port. We're a hub for the ferries. This place will always buzz. Good people, you know.
And a warm welcome.
Absolutely, yes. Even more so, I hear it on a daily basis in my own business about how nice people are here. And it's the way it should be, though. I mean, that's West Highlanders for you.
Johnny McMillan and Malik there, and that's us. We've actually arrived. Ewan's risking life and limb by opening the door before the train's actually stopped. But never mind. Gedunk.
I'll be a stop there.
I'll be a stop.
Yo. Look at that brilliant sunshine steam train. Excellent.
An hour and 50 minutes. It took you back in time. It's an experience you're probably not going to get in very many places in the world, never mind in the UK. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for.
From all of the team here at Maleg, first off, thank you to everybody who's cooperated with us today. It's been an outstanding experience. Secondly, thank you very much for listening. Join us next week if you can. From me, Mark Stephen, goodbye.